Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome, my good friends, to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Our guests today will be six members of law enforcement against prohibition. Up till this point, we've had 8 or 10 other members of law enforcement against prohibition. And by the way, their website, leap.cc. These are former drug warriors, people who have served in the trenches, locking up the millions of Americans for use of certain drugs, and who have now seen the light, and who are working to end prohibition. We'll also mix in a report from Doug McVeigh, the computer guru who works for Common Sense for Drug Policy, their website, csdp.org, and for drugwarfacts.org. This is all designed, my friends, to give you courage to help make the change.
My name is Charles Earl Barnett, and I'm a retired law enforcement officer. I retired as a major, the second in command of the Sheriff's Office in Greenville, South Carolina. We have an agency of approximately 500 sworn officers.
The drug war represents a major portion of the work done by law enforcement, does it not?
That's correct. On the federal, state, and local level, there's a fairly massive amount of money that is being spent to enforce drug laws in this country.
And what has been your experience? Have the efforts of law enforcement cut down on the number of users or prevented our youth from having access?
In my opinion, no. I have gone back and looked at our reports from several years ago with the sheriff's office and looked at the amount of drugs that were seized, the categories they were seized in, and the value at the time. And here, 10 years later, the only change is that we're seizing more drugs off the street. The value hasn't changed very much, except that the quality of the drugs is getting higher, such as with cocaine and especially heroin.
What might be a better solution than our current tactics?
I think education is the direction that we need to go into. This business of the government punishing individuals because they choose to make a wrong decision for themselves just seems to be non-productive. I was just reading an article by our governor on another issue altogether, and he talked about his support of the fact that, or his belief, that liberty is what our country should be most supportive of, you know, rather than trying to protect ourselves from one's own actions. You know, a lot of people in government who pass these laws say, well, you know, this is harmful and we have to protect people. Well, no, you don't. It's more important for me to have liberty in this country. And if you acknowledge and understand the fact that people will do things to harm themselves occasionally, you cannot make a law possibly to protect everybody from their bad decisions. It's just not possible.
Each week I read stories about police corruption or the district attorneys using drugs and just various ways that enormous flaws are seen in how this system is instigated. And how do we stop that corruption?
Well, as far as stopping the corruption, you can't. It's just a massive flow of money. And there are individuals who have who just simply don't have the high moral standard that we expect of our public officials. And there's corruption. There always has been corruption. But I tell you, if you want to see a really good overview of what's going on, the dynamics of what's going on in drug prohibition, you simply have to go back in our country's history not very long ago to alcohol prohibition. And there you will find that we had the very, very same things going on. You had killing of innocent people by law enforcement agents, and the government justified it, saying that, well, they didn't use the term collateral damage as we use now, but they basically said, you know, these were justifiable actions, you know, by law enforcement officers, and it was simply an unfortunate loss of innocent life, but it was understandable, you know, in the war against alcohol. Well, we lost that one, and we lost it big time. And even though today I still hear some people say that, you know, we need to just ban alcohol as well. The fact is, you announce a war against our own people, you know, when you do things like that. And the war against drugs is nothing less than that. It's a war against our own people.
A war against our own people. Don't you think it's time that we all do something to end this 90-year-old fiasco? Our next member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is Fred Martins.
My name's Fred Martins. I've worked with the New Jersey State Police in an undercover capacity, conducting organized crime and narcotics investigations. I was the executive director of the Pennsylvania Crime Commission, and I've written extensively on the topic of organized crime control. We may want to think about different ways to address the prohibition if we're not going to be sensitive to and committed to addressing the corruption issues. I would strongly suggest that, you know, we look at terms of de-emphasizing. Some might call it decriminalizing. I'll call it de-emphasizing certain aspects of the drug war. For instance, there are aspects of the drug war that perhaps we don't need to put the kinds of resources we've put into it. Marijuana certainly being one area of the drug war that could be addressed differently. Prescription drugs is another area of the drug war that could be addressed differently. I can't conceive of the likelihood that we'll ever see the legalization of heroin, although when you stop and think about it, we've essentially done that in a more oblique way by legalizing methadone maintenance programs. So that might even have a more, that might be a viable option. The other area that will, I think, really confound us is the whole area of cocaine and crack and methamphetamine, where I don't see any likelihood in the near future that we're going to change the nature of the criminalization of those drugs. In that particular area, one may want to focus more efforts towards, again, the containment of the corruption that comes from those drugs.
What if we put the coca back in that cola?
What if we put the coca back in the cola? We probably have a lot of people that drink a lot of Coca-Cola. You know, I mean, we can't deny that there's addictive qualities to drugs, just like there are is to nicotine. And, you know, addiction is a reality. Why certain people get addicted and others don't is another reality. So when you say if we put the cola, the cocoa back into the Coca-Cola, we probably have more people drinking Coca-Cola.
But I think we'd have a lot less violence on the streets.
Well, and, you know, that's an issue that certainly emanates from the prohibition of drugs. It's violence is an issue, but I see corruption as the bigger issue. I think that when corruption takes over governments like it has in Colombia, where you got to make truces with the drug cartels, it says something about the inability of government to address the fundamental issue of integrity.
Okay, we're going to take a little break from this Orwellian discussion, if you will, and let's talk to Mark Emery, the Prince of Pot up in Canada, the purveyor of Pot TV, the publisher of Cannabis Culture magazine. Mark tells me they've got a new staff and they're working hard to bring the magazine back to a lot like it used to be, more user-friendly, if you will.
One of the things I've been critical about in our society recently is the number of students, children, who are being rounded up in both the United States and Canada at schools or targeted for, you know, adults go in and pose as their friends who are police officers and seduce these young kids into selling them pot, and then they face charges. And this is happening everywhere from Nova Scotia, Canada, British Columbia, Canada, where police officers are inducing young people to sell them small quantities of weed and then arresting them, where these kids have their lives ruined by prison terms, by a criminal record, by, you know, very onerous punishments put on them, including one young fellow who had 30 grams of pot in Illinois, in Lincoln, Illinois, and was sentenced to 6 years in jail, including 6 months in a high-impact boot camp, you know, so all for 30 grams of marijuana. you know, normally people think that Canada's free from that, but in fact last year I went to a courthouse in Sydney, Nova Scotia to protest the fact that a young 18-year-old whose marks were in the 90s, 90 percentile, no criminal record whatsoever, got 90 days in jail for selling a few $5 half-gram bags at a school dance, you know. And of course I myself went to jail on a 3-month sentence in Saskatoon last year for just passing one joint. So they're really targeting young people a lot now. Young people have always been a big target of the drug war, but it's really escalating. You know, they're passing, you know, treating young people in the United States as adults when they're only 15 and 16, like in Florida. Most recently in Palm Beach County, students were infiltrated by undercover police officer adults who solicited them for drugs. The kids sell them a bit of pot, and now they're facing up to 15 years in jail, tried in adult courts, and treated like, you know, the worst criminal menace to society. And this is an epidemic all across North America.
I'm not going back to jail for a bag of weed.
Out of the car, motherfucker!
Get your hands up where we can see them! Oh my God, he's dead!
One last criminal on the streets.
He keeps saying marijuana's harmless. Certainly not today.
Fight or flight, what will you do? What will you do? Please visit drugwarfacts.org.
Here's our next member of law enforcement against prohibition. His name is Lee Schwartz, and he's a former Dade County police officer.
And people often say to me, how can you control it? There'll always be a market for the bad guy. And I agree. It's no different than alcohol. There is still a certain small market, very small, that manufactures it. It's infinitesimal. There's nothing to it. By the same token, there's no question some kids can buy alcohol or tobacco, but it is so controlled it is very difficult. It is more difficult to buy alcohol or tobacco for a minor than it is to go buy drugs. And I have asked kids in front of their parents, if you wanted to, and I'm not saying you do, but if you wanted to buy drugs, could you buy them? Inevitably they say yes. Do you know exactly where to go or who to see? Yes. Could you get almost anything you wanted? Yes. It's here. And I think many people bury their heads in the sand and follow the concept that I believed for so many years. Lock them up. Forget them. And we have wasted not only these billions and billions of dollars, we have wasted the lives of these kids. And I have heard people after they listen to a Leap talk, a speaker, and they will say, they'll come up to you afterwards, and these are professional people that will say, thank goodness I never got caught. I used marijuana when I was in school. Thank goodness I never got caught because I experimented with drugs. Had they been caught, they'd have been finished. Their lives would have been ruined. They would have never gone on to be successful business people. They would have never been an asset to the community, to life itself, because they would have been branded under our present system as drug users, and we have no use for drug users. We don't want them in the colleges. We don't want them in the various professions such as law enforcement, attorneys. And you go down the list and you say, my, what a waste this would have been had these people been caught. Just because somebody uses a drug one time doesn't mean that they're going to become addicted. And unfortunately or unfortunately, we learn that many people, many well-known people who have been caught using drugs have been leading productive lives even though they were using these drugs. Personally, I have two sons and a daughter who are in their early 40s, late 30s. I hope none of them ever use it. But if they do, I hope it's under a controlled situation.
There was a story that broke over the past couple of weeks of a West Texas attorney who just got reelected for being tough on drugs. Yet, he was found with methamphetamine, cocaine, marijuana, and 31 guns by a group of federal agents. Your thoughts on that hypocrisy?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's life itself. Many, many people, they are hypocrites. But this is in all phases of life. These holier-than-thous that get on their soapbox and preach against the evils that society does, and oftentimes these are the same people that are doing these things. But it's almost no news, but it gives you a certain smugness, some certain satisfaction to realize that these same people that are advocating not doing something are doing it, and for them, it's okay in their mind.
Members of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, these former cops and prosecutors, wardens and judges, many have Saul turns to Paul stories with strong reservations and deep regret over the thousands of basically innocent people they've sent to prison.
My name is Martha DeWolf, and I'm a retired police sergeant. I'm a reformed drug warrior, and I am trying to educate the world now that we really need to handle drug abuse as a health issue and not as a law enforcement issue.
That's really the problem, that you go back 90 years, it was considered a health issue, but we've changed that focus. You want to talk about what we've done with that focus?
Actually, I think that what's happened is basically a demonization of some drug users of substances that are determined illegal drugs. It has so many factors that have led to the state that we're in today, with our war on drugs being a war by some drug users, basically, against other drug users. One of the earlier factors was the politics that surrounded cannabis back in the 1930s. And so you can see we're fighting a long, long history of demonization of drug users. I first became aware of it as a school child when police narcotic officers would come in the school and tell us about how drugs were bad. I was like in second grade. And looking back, I remember that most of the damages that they ascribed to marijuana, I've learned since then, can be attributed mostly to alcohol. And so I grew up with such a fear, for example, of marijuana and people who used it, that when I was a police officer and I'd gone through the academy and learned how to enforce the laws, anytime I found somebody that had drugs that were classed illegal on them, or even paraphernalia, I would arrest those people and take them to jail, thinking that I was doing a good thing, because I'd basically been indoctrinated, to believe that people who used these illegal drugs were also people who neglected their children, people who stole things to support their drug habits. I wasn't even allowed to entertain the concept that people might be able to use these drugs without becoming hideously addicted. And so, after my own long ordeal of pain that I've been through from my 10 years as a police officer and, number of fights and falls and foot chases and so forth, I took all kinds of prescription drugs because of my pain. I've been to a number of hospitalizations, been through a number of those. None of the pain prescriptions that I had would allow me to live any kind of a normal life. I took a disability retirement, and for example, even this morning, my husband just finished icing my shoulders, which we still do regularly. I discovered medical cannabis after moving to California, and that's what opened my eyes to the possibility that I had been lied to as a police officer. And since then, I've started researching the drug war on my own and found that we, as police officers, were basically propagandized just like the rest of the population. Now I'm trying to turn some of that around so that in the time I have left, maybe I can help us bring it back to a level of health and compassion instead of law enforcement and imprisonment.
As I mentioned earlier, we do have a new reporter on staff. His name is Doug McVeigh, and he's the computer guru for Common Sense for Drug Policy and for DrugWarFacts.org. We couldn't possibly find a more astute and aware reporter for the Drug Truth Network, and here's his first report on Drug War Facts.
You may have read about new research showing marijuana's effect on the flow of blood through the brain. What you may not have read was that in this study, the light users smoked an average of 11.5 joints a week. The study's so-called moderate users smoked 10 joints a day. Heavy users supposedly consumed up to 50 joints per day. Back closer to the real world, in 2001, the Federal Drug Czar's Office estimated that an American marijuana user, on average, consumed just 18.7 joints per month, each joint containing an average 0.39 grams of pot, a tad lighter than the amount of tobacco in a typical U.S. cigarette. Does marijuana affect the flow of blood? Yes, it seems to. Is it a serious concern for recreational users? Who knows? The sort of politicized research NIDA produces won't give us any good answers. For the Drug Truth Network, this has been Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Today's Name That Drug is an oldie but a goodie. Surely you can remember. It's time to play Name That Drug by its side effects. Abnormal dreams, confusion, coughing up blood, decreased sensitivity to stimulation, decreased sex drive, difficulty concentrating, difficulty speaking, hepatitis, impotence, memory loss, and sensitivity to light. Time's up. The answer, Claritin. Another FDA-approved product. And now more from Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Leap.cc.
Hi, I'm Jerry Cameron, a retired police chief and a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. If you could point to success, to real success, you know, there may be some argument for continuing this. If I could snap my fingers and make alcohol or any other drug go away, I would do it. But every attempt to force people to comply with your idea of good decisions has always produced serious consequences in society. Prohibition created some terrible consequences, and we've got the same sort of things going on today. An intermediate step would be not just openly legalizing it, perhaps, but decriminalizing it and giving some government control over distribution.
There's so much corruption within law enforcement, within the border agents, within many of the, you know, justice systems that get tainted, that get corrupted by that drug money. Let's talk about that aspect, if you will.
Well, it's not just the open corruption that you have, which does occur in what thankfully is not the majority of law enforcement, but certainly a significant portion that you should be worried about. But the fact that the drug dealers and the government feed off of each other, the drug dealers are absolutely necessary to the continued expansion of government agencies and equipment and money, and the government is absolutely necessary to the drug dealers to keep the profit margins up and suppress competition.
So in essence, they're working hand in hand as we go in further into this.
It's a symbiotic relationship. One really depends on the other.
Let me ask you this. As a former member of a working law enforcement staff, is there any idea of a percentage, a number of those who are involved or corrupted by these drug dollars?
You can hardly go a week or two without picking up a paper in some part of the country and finding out where someone has tainted their honor as a result of their involvement in the drug trade. It's just such a seamy business that it tends to distort your perception of values when you stay in it too long.
We've been speaking with Jerry Cameron, a South Augustine, Florida retired sheriff. Jerry, any closing comments of what possibilities might exist, what we might do to change this scenario?
Well, you know, Einstein himself said that the very definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over and expect a different result. I think that when you're talking about our government spending on all levels upwards of $80 billion a year for something that produces counterproductive results, that it is time to make changes and to start working your way back to where you started.
Okay, we have just enough time to hear from one more member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And before we wrap this up, I want the listeners to understand one thing. These gentlemen are not getting paid to do this. They're doing this because they feel this in their heart. They feel that through years of observation and experience, it's time to change this drug war. And I feel certain that their words ring true with your ears.
My name is Jim Girac. I'm an attorney. Started out as a new lawyer, as a prosecutor in Cook County, which, of course, is Chicago. Worked there for 4 years, then went into private practice, and altogether have about 35 years practicing law.
And you are, sir, a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition?
I most certainly am.
As I understand it, sir, the Northeast in particular is suffering from an influx of very high-potency heroin, and the price is dropping through the floor. You want to talk about that, sir?
Because drug dealers can see that the way to make money is to bring a drug in of whatever sort, whether it's heroin or whatever, and then the police have a successful drug bust, and they seize a ton, say, of cocaine or heroin, doesn't matter. And if, in fact, the seizure was large enough to affect the availability of the drug in the area where the seizure occurred, we now have a shortage of drugs in a given geographic area. So the other drug dealers are rushing in with their supply of drugs to get the artificially inflated price because of the scarcity. So the economics of drug prohibition accomplishes that which it is intended to prevent. And then because the price went up and all these drug dealers are rushing the drugs in, we now have a multitude of a huge supply of drugs, and so now the price falls. So the effect of the economics of prohibition is to put more drugs everywhere, and more pure and at less price.
Now, is it not that confluence that occurs when there is a shortage that pits these drug dealers against one another for that turf and creates that violence?
Well, the turf wars are endless. I mean, if we lock up every drug dealer today, how many drug dealers do you have tomorrow? Exactly the same number, because it's the attraction of the money that you can make in the drug business that brings a new crew of people in. And because of the value of that drug turf, you have the kids shooting one another endlessly. In the middle 90s, we would have 12 kids in a weekend killed in Chicago. Most of them gang murders, fighting over drug turf.
We have to go about this incrementally, I suppose, and if you could change one aspect, where would you begin to make those changes?
Well, first of all, I don't think it needs to be incrementally. When prohibition of alcohol ended, it ended in one fell swoop. And within a year or two of the time that it had ended, Senator had predicted that there's as much chance of ending alcohol prohibition as flying the National Monument to the moon on the back of a gnat. Well, I think that the economics of the drug war is unaffordable. We can't afford the prisons and be able to afford the schools. So when we have more and more parents recognizing that, well, we're wasting all this money on prisons so that we can't pay for schools, the kids still have drugs available everywhere, that the crime in some communities is continuing to be rampant, I don't think it's going to be an incremental change. I think the roof is going to fall in, and it's going to be because we cannot afford the economic costs of prohibition that puts more drugs everywhere and does nothing helpful to kids, particularly keeping drugs from them.
Once again, I want to steer you to the website of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, leap.cc. As always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag. Please, be careful. For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Jam dancing on the edge of an abyss.